This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning, folks. Thank you for starting your Friday with us on The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Ibrahim Sani here with me. 6 o'clock on Friday. Are you an extra happy boy today on Friday?
Yeah, very much so. because after all, it is Friday and it's Black Friday in the US, I suppose.
Yes, that's right. You know, yesterday, I had at the start of the week remembered that this was Thanksgiving week, and yesterday completely forgot that it was Thanksgiving. I didn't understand why there was kind of a ruckus in my neighbor's house, and I was like, "Wow, they're throwing a party on a Thursday night. What's going on?" And I realized, "Oh yeah, it's Thanksgiving dinner."
It's Thanksgiving. you have American friends?
I think so. I think there are a couple of expats in my building, That's probably why they had some. We also had a party last night, didn't we?
We did.
Yeah, not Thanksgiving, but we had our final network series of the year. We had a small gathering of BFM community. You had to sign up to be part of this community, and we had a few people over to chat about the investment landscape and how we see that going forward next year. I thought it was interesting until it kind of took a gloomy turn, because it seems that everyone was rather pessimistic. And I just like to say that even though it does look like it's a kind of a gloomy outlook for the next year, I mean, that's just a small part. We have to look much further than that, right?
Yeah, of course. That is the mood or the theme, right? Whether or not you're optimistic or pessimistic. But at the same time, it's important to know that this is the kind of conversation that we have to have.
Yeah, you're right.
We can't just be sweeping stuff under the carpet, right?
It's kind of like straight talking. You have to tell it as how it is.
Absolutely.
Because sometimes you might get, analyst reports that say, look, you know, it's not as bad as it seems. And you don't want to be cushioned. You don't want to be for bad news to be cushioned. Sometimes you need the straight talking.
Okay, so just to draw some parallel, if you're sick, right? Would you rather know what you have, or would you rather postpone that kind of appointment with the doctor?
I want to know what I have.
Straight up.
And also, if someone close to me was sick, I would rather they tell me rather than, you know, the old school way of shielding me from the pain. That's old school. That doesn't work anymore. Let's support and be in it together.
So that's the thing. Even within my own family, my nucleus family, it's divided in terms of how to manage this kind of information, right? And I think, if we extrapolate that to the rest of the country, it's the same thing. People might not want to, know everything, but at the same time, half of the other people, they want to know everything.
But I think, Ibrahim, that it's a sign of a mature society, the ability to have difficult conversations, right? The ability to face the truth and to tell it as it is. So, when it's not going right, for government to say, yeah, we messed up, or this is not going right, we have to fix it. It is a sign of a mature society. And I think perhaps, baby steps, we're not there yet, but baby steps. Mm-hmm. But speaking about health and medicine, you mentioned about wellness and keeping healthy. Telemedicine is now the new frontier in the healthcare sector. It utilizes telecommunication and technology to take healthcare into the information age. And that is the topic of the Breakfast Grill today. We're going to have a panel on how Malaysian healthcare providers are preparing for the change in the healthcare sector through telemedicine, and whether we, in fact, have the research capabilities to do it.
Yeah, so we have on the panel Professor Dr. Wong Chi Piao, the chairman of Telemedicine Conference, as well as Jeffrey Ibrahim, CEO of Crest. They will look into whether or not this is indeed something very interesting to shape our conversation for the future. Of course, Crest their members actually, it actually stands for Catalyst for Malaysia's ENE. They shape the conversation on telemedicine, and it's very timely for us to actually look into this for 2016.
Have you heard of telemedicine? To be completely honest, before the Breakfast Grill, before thinking about the research of this Breakfast Grill, I hadn't actually given much thought about telemedicine.
Yeah, same here actually. I don't know much about it. I think because Julian's going to be having this conversation, I think it's important for, at least for me, to actually listen in and see what's all this about.
Essentially, it's just it was originally created, what I understand from it is that it was originally created to provide doctor's consultation for patients in remote places. So places where doctors can't get there. Perhaps, you know, they have a phone call or a Skype call and they're able to give a consultation. My question is whether this has been adopted, you know, mass adopted in, say, places like Malaysia, where, yeah, say, rural East Malaysia, where you can't get there. And whether that's a good thing, because sometimes doctors bring more than the ability to diagnose. They have that personal touch, right? It's called bedside manner,
yeah,
is that right?
Yeah, bedside manner. And that human touch, because sometimes when, you know, my wife usually does this, right?
She's in medicine as well,
yeah,
right? Yes.
So if I fall down and you know, and
does she teleconference you?
No, no. You know, if she asks, does it hurt while you know she pinches on that particular leg or whatever, and I say no, but I'm grimacing, you know. So that's bedside manners, right?
She's not listening to what you're saying.
Yeah.
She's actually watching your body language.
Absolutely. So I don't know whether this kind of little things can come across through telemedicine.
Ah, interesting. That's a good anecdote. Well, let's find out more about telemedicine, this very nascent field in the healthcare sector, with our panel on The Breakfast Grill today. And we will continue our conversation on the demonetization process in India. Yesterday, we spoke about it on Current Affairs at 8:35. Let's continue that today, because the deadline for using the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes in India ended last night. So what's actually happened has been chaos in the past couple of weeks. People have been standing in long lines in queues. Oh, bless you. Bless you in the morning. So, and now what we want to do on Current Affairs, in fact, we spoke to someone in India. She's Padma Priya Govinda Rajan. She's a correspondent at The Diplomat. And she told us that there's been a rise in death cases in among Indian citizens due to the long hours of standing outside banks. Here she is.
Obviously, things look pretty bad in those fronts. And I don't think the government necessarily predicted that this would be the scale of panic and this would be the scale of exhaustion and fear. So I think that it's definitely problematic that this is happening. And I also think that in large part due to the fact that a lot of people who hitherto didn't use banking facilities too much or hitherto used primarily cash or hoarding of cash at home as their way of conducting everyday transactions are suddenly forced to engage with the banking system that they didn't really so regularly engage with before, which means that this kind of panic and this kind of the long queues and the exhaustion is to be expected. That doesn't obviously mean it's good at all. And obviously, that's not at all probably what the government intended. But unfortunately, it's one of the worst consequences of this policy.
That was Padma Priya Govinda Rajan from The Diplomat. She's based in India. And gosh, I mean, who would have thought that this demonetization move by Narendra Modi would have caused a rise in death? If you think about it, Ibrahim, I mean, let's just say we wake up early in the morning, we've done our day, and now we have to go and stand in line for 3 to 4 hours a day with no guarantee that we will get the money that mm-hmm. we need. And it's just, I can imagine the stress and the worry and the anxiety and the exhaustion that sets in.
And I've seen a BBC documentary on this this week where the level of stress is actually phenomenal because it does impact. Get this. This law, the demonetization or taking out the 500 and 1,000 rupees out of circulation, was meant to curb corruption and handle the upper mass affluent. But it's actually the lower mass and the middle market that is actually impacted the most. We covered the news a few days ago that employers are paying out salaries in advance. They just want to get rid of that cash. And this has taken a toll on many of these lower workers in India.
I was listening to an episode, a podcast episode of Planet Money, and they cited an example of a young man who was going to get married in December, and he had saved up all this money to pay for his wedding. So now as his wedding approaches, he can't pay the people, all his suppliers, suppliers. So he's gotten all his cousins and uncles and all to wait in line for hours on end to convert the money so they can pay.
Oh my God.
Yeah, can you imagine? I mean,
so
that's
it's this little
yeah,
things,
it's the nuggets
right?
like that. Yeah, that you didn't, like you didn't realize that how much it affects society. Well, more on that at 8:35 a.m. I'm really curious to know how the policy has affected people from across the social spectrum in India. At 9:35 a.m., we have the property show, and it's the final Friday of the month, meaning that it's time for our monthly legal property clinic with Chris Tan of Cheer Associates. Now, the question that we've gotten from a listener that Chris will be addressing in this in today's show, in this month's show, is what does one do about an empty plot of land next to a property that one intends to buy? What a valid question, because you have absolutely no control over who buys that empty plot of land. And I wonder whether that would affect your buying decision, right? Whether you want to buy that property.
Yeah, and this is not in theory, at least in my case, because the property in Johor, my family actually had a very interesting plot of land there. And remember, this is before the Forest City, Country Garden, the whole thing, right? I'm talking about 1990s. And they actually didn't want to buy that plot of land in Johor Bahru because of a huge empty plot of land next to that property, the target property that they want to get. But they just bought it anyway. And, you know, in hindsight, it was a poor decision because they built a massive, you know,
condo.
Condo.
Like a big structure. Okay.
Yeah, it's like a Soho. It's like a condo slash office building. And I don't know how the municipality worked it out, but the plot ratio was a bit, you know, messed up. You have this high density condo, but it's a very small road leading to that. So you have a
congestion.
Lot of this congestion,
oh,
right?
Goodness.
And in Malaysia, everybody must have like 9 cars or 10 cars to their name. It's amazing.
Actually, 2.5, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So you have all these cars lining up, you know, against this very small road. It's a hell of a property to own, and my family actually has actually discarded that property a few years back, but that whole, you know, they spent a fortune trying to get that property, and in selling that property, it's just a huge waste of time. Actually,
I have a bit more of a first world problem when it comes to this question. So my apartment in Penang, when our family bought that place and we lived in it for a long time, we loved it because we bought it because it had a view of Penang Bridge. So it had wonderful uninterrupted view of Penang Bridge. So you could just stand at the balcony and just look at the bridge and be proud to be Penangite.
Yeah.
And before we bought it, the land in front of us we knew was being reclaimed, and we knew there was going to be some development. And lo and behold, they built the biggest, ugliest monstrosity in front of our apartment, blocking a wonderful view of Penang Bridge. So although that is a bit more of a first world problem, I do realize that in hindsight, my mother raised questions, you know, should we buy this? You know, look, there's an empty plot of land. Maybe they might build something. And yes, they did. Moms are always right. Okay, so well, let's find out more. If you have a similar, you're in a similar conundrum, this is the show for you, the property show with Chris Tan of Cheer Associates for a monthly legal property clinic. Now, let's take a quick look at the news today, Ibrahim. It's been quite an interesting news cycle, because Al Jazeera recently, in an exclusive documentary that airs today, in fact, they uncovered a thriving trade in Malaysia where babies are being sold like commodities, often with the help of corrupt governments. So they've exposed how easy it is to buy a baby in Malaysia, where traffickers even offer potential customers catalogues of pregnant women to choose from.
Yeah, and of course, this price is basically determined by the skin color, the gender, the weight. Boys would get different prices from girls, for instance. Doctors and government officials will falsify documents to allow for this transaction to happen. And, you know, you hear these things happening in countries in Asia and beyond, but we haven't gotten proof so far. So for Al Jazeera to actually have this uncovered, it's extremely telling, actually. Mm.
Well, they had 4 months of covert investigations to build up to this documentary. And really, I am quite astonished, because you hear about it and you think it happens, you know, in other countries, in other developing countries. But to hear that here in Malaysia, Australia, you can actually buy a baby online like it's a supermarket. So Hartini Zainuddin, who's quoted in the documentary, she's a child's rights activist. She told Al Jazeera that the trade is like a supermarket. You can buy the baby online. And like you said, Ibrahim, it's boys that are usually that fetch the highest price, especially if they're fair skinned. And we're talking about like $1,005 US. The range is between $1,005 to $2,005 US for a baby. I mean, that's the price of a human baby.
Yeah. And you know, so my friend, a good friend of mine, he actually adopted a baby, and he realized how tough.
What was that like?
It was tough for him. It was the whole process actually took close to 2 years.
Wow.
He's been married, and they found out that one of the partners is sterile.
Infertile.
Infertile. So they're fine with it. They moved on past that and they want to adopt. And the whole process took them 2 years. So some of these critics actually blame Malaysia's complex adoption laws for creating that underground market. And my friend is one of those. He is a strong critique of these adoption laws in Malaysia.
Mm.
It doesn't make it easier for us to adopt children. And because of that, I think people are now moving towards the underground market.
I suspect this Al Jazeera documentary will create quite a buzz, given that corrupt doctors and government officials who have been falsifying birth documents will be uncovered. So let's find out if there's any follow through from this Al Jazeera investigation that's I think going to go on air today. You can catch that, I think, online. All right, it's now 6:16. We'll be back with more news, so stay tuned to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Good morning, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Ibrahim Sani and Stevie Wonder. Not in the studio, but that was Stevie Wonder for once in my life there. Okay, 6:21 right now, and we're going to take a look at some other news that's trending at the moment. Online media last night was abuzz with the ambush on MP Khalid Samad, the MP from Parti Amanah Negara. So yesterday, two men from a group who identified themselves as Pasir Salah UMNO members had attempted to attack Khalid. But it was the prompt action of several parliamentary security officers who intervened. They took the punches from those two guys and they saved the Shah Alam MP from any bodily harm.
So the police actually revealed that one of the assaulters was Firdaus Tajuddin, the son of the Deputy Minister and Pasir Salah MP, Datuk Sri Tajuddin Rahman. He was among the 10 suspects involved. And the altercation came after, if you don't know this, Melissa, this is the spat between Khalid Samad and Tajuddin Rahman. And this is...
Yeah, Tajuddin made some comments about Saputi MP Teresa Kok, and then I think Khalid had come out to...
The
war of words with Tajuddin.
Now, like I said, I was reading the handset. These are the things that I do that I'm particularly ashamed of myself because I read handset in my free time. And Teresa Kwok was actually arguing on the budget. And, you know, inadvertently, I was reading the passage where Pasir Salah was actually arguing. And he utters a few words that had double meaning. And, you know, Khalid Samad, for whatever reason, defended the honour and dignity of his fellow parliamentarian, Teresa Kwok. And he, too, uttered very interesting choice words.
He did utter some choice words. So he, I guess, the same thing stooped to Tajuddin's level.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. I'm not going
to
argue that.
I have to ask, though, you know, in coming back from back to our conversation about mature societies having difficult conversations, the ability to argue and disagree and have discourse, essentially just to talk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this is, I guess, you know, 3, 4, 5 steps back in the opposite direction, right?
Absolutely.
However, if you see Japan, if you look at... you know, other countries, they too have ugly fights in their parliament.
Yeah, it's a brawl, I would say.
Do you remember Japan with a shoe?
Japan with a shoe, Taiwan with the actually throwing the seats, literally seats. They have since bolted down the seats in the Taiwan parliament. I'm not making this up. These are the things that people do.
That's good.
And of course, this is not the first time that our parliamentarians have been attacked on holy ground, if I may say.
Yeah, so do you see Parliament as holy ground? And that's a question, right? Is Parliament an arena for anything goes, for I will debate you to the ends of the world and, you know, call whatever names.
No,
yeah. Or should it be, you know, we respect the sanctity of parliament?
No, no, I mean, absolutely, right? I mean, anything goes in the parliament in terms of words, but the moment you're attacked in the parliament, that's a different story.
Right.
This is not the first time our parliamentarians have been attacked.
Oh, really?
If you remember Karpal Singh, the late Karpal Singh, he was being attacked as well. And even more so because he was on a wheelchair already by then. There was other instances, the MP for Mapanta in Ruiza, she too was being harassed and attacked. But every single time, the parliamentary security officers, the auxiliary policemen, they do step in and intervene. But whatever it is, right, for whatever reason, people do have the access to it. Parliament is still public access. You can still, you have a right to actually attend the
You do.
Sitting.
However, you can only enter, if you're not pressed, you can only enter at the invitation of an MP. So parliament security is really tight.
Mm.
It remains to be seen how these two got into parliament grounds.
Maybe because his father invited him and his father is an MP.
No verification on that yet.
Yeah, no,
but,
yeah.
You know, it's a question that the police, I'm sure, are investigating. Okay, 6:25 right now. Over in Singapore, SingPost recently said that Singaporeans apparently seem to welcome junk mail because, you know, while some residents might complain about their mailbox being clogged up with everything from promotional offers to furniture catalogues and discounts from your local grocery store, Singapore residents have not signed up, have not opted out from receiving these advertisements. So SingPost has this program where you can sign up, where Singaporeans can sign up, and they have a little sticker on their mailbox that says no junk mail. I think it's no unaddressed post,
mm-hmm.
Not unaddressed ads. And only 0.8% of the 1 million Singapore households have only signed up. So
yeah.
People not interested. They love their junk mail.
They love their junk mail. And I can understand why. Because when I was growing up in Australia, I was a delivery boy delivering junk mail.
Flyers and leaflets.
Flyers.
Okay.
I can understand why they don't want, they still want junk mail because, you know, Singaporeans, forgive my words, but they're very particular about promotional offers.
They want a good bargain.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And they do keep track of their coupons and all that. So, yes.
I am embarrassed to admit that I love catalogues. I love catalogues. I love those stupid catalogues that come into my mailbox. I'll look at them and I'll circle them. I'll mark the pages of which ones I want to buy. And I never buy them. I just like looking at them. It's like, it is essentially browsing, it's window shopping on the comfort of my couch.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, what is more telling is that, you know, mail is still relevant in today's culture and society, even though we do everything digitally. And even when Singapore as a society is extremely advanced in their technology and the e-commerce revolution, remember, we covered this news a few weeks back, their central bank is already doing interbank settlement using cryptocurrency.
That's right.
Many other stuff. But they still like junk mail. And that's very, you know, very novel for me.
That's a really good point to make because according to the British Post, they saw a decline. So Royal Mail in England, they saw a decline in junk mail sent by post following the Brexit vote, the Brexit referendum. And that, to me, speaks of, I guess, a dip in sentiment of businesses. So they don't see the need to send out promotional flyers. They're not optimistic about the future. And it's really quite interesting to see junk mail used as a gauge for business sentiment.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a correlation, right? Because some of the traditional British stuff, including Vegemite and all the other, you know, brands, household names, they actually jacked up their prices after the Brexit vote. So they're, you know, businesses, they weren't trying to fight for discounts. They're actually trying to increase prices.
Okay, a quick look at our Twitter feed. So yesterday, Nasira Kutin is not here today, but he's requested that we take a look at a poll that he put out yesterday. We were talking about this 24-year-old woman who's been elected a deputy minister in Ukraine. Now, the backlash was that she was said to be too young to lead a country. So we kind of put it out there on a Twitter poll to see if age matters to you when you think about your ministers and your leaders. Would you be welcoming of a 20-something-year-old minister? Granted, we didn't put the gender element in there, but 62% of our Twitter respondents said they would be welcoming of a young minister, a 20-something minister.
And this is over 200 votes that have been cast, and it kind of shows that people still have faith in the youth. And we do have 20-something that is active in the corporate landscape as well as the political landscape in Malaysia. So perhaps a poll like this does give them hope to lead.
Okay, well, it's too late to weigh in now, but it was a very interesting conversation indeed. So it's coming up to 6:30. We've got the news bulletin, the first news bulletin of the day with Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Aerosmith, To the Other Side. Hello and good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. 6:40 right now. It's Friday, the 25th of November, or Black Friday in the US, the start of the shopping season, the Christmas shopping season there. And I'm Melissa Idris with Ibrahim Sani this morning. Now, there's new research. There's a new study that came out to say that actually only half of your friends like you. Now, what a way to bum you out on a Friday morning to realize that actually your circle of friends is smaller than you thought. So when someone calls you a friend, it goes without saying that they too consider you as a friend. You know, you like them, they like you. Mm-hmm. It's a reciprocal thing. But apparently, it's only true 50% of the time that perceived friendships are actually mutual. This is research from MIT, Ibrahim. We cannot dispute.
Right. Well, any research I can dispute. just to clarify, right, just because, only half of your friends actually like you doesn't mean the other half hate you.
They just don't think of you as a friend.
They just don't think of you as a friend, nor do they think of you as an enemy. So it's like a neutral kind of thing.
That bodes the question, why does that happen? Do we project our friendship onto someone and we say, oh, I really like this person, I think we vibe well together?
Yeah.
And actually, you don't see that the other person doesn't feel the same way.
Absolutely.
What's going on here?
Because you need chemistry for the thing to work. And sometimes, in fact, most of the times, we look at relationships as a necessity to move ahead in your day-to-day activity. And you have to realize that you have to think about the way to manage that kind of work ethic, the kind of manage the relationship within your neighborhood. And all this boils down to the fact that sometimes you just need to be friends with somebody even though you don't like it.
I think there's a way, I mean, that sometimes we confuse friendship with acquaintances, or sometimes proximity often breeds fondness. So I sometimes think that we confuse friendship with that. So I'm going to ask you a difficult question, Brian, put you on the spot here for a bit.
Yeah.
How would you define friendship?
Well,
tough one. It's a tough one.
For me, a friendship works when you do something that you don't expect anything in return, any favors.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Oh.
And sometimes you kind of have to expect that these are the questions that you are going to ask me when we talk about this. So I have it all prepped up. I have it all prepped up in my nice notes here.
Oh, good, good. Very. You anticipated it.
Yeah, but, isn't that the logical argument, right? Because with a colleague, when a colleague asks you to do something, let's say, I plan to go on leave this Friday. Can you cover for me?
Don't talk to about Shirakutan like that.
You're like, yeah, sure, of course, I can help you. Because at the back of your mind, you're going to cash in on this favor.
Because one day you're going
to day, and very soon, it's going to be next week, by the way, Sharad, if you're listening in.
I have to dispute that, though. There's something, to expect friendship to be self-sacrificial, right? So you can do something without expecting anything in return. I think is that the true meaning of friendship? Because the idea is real friendship, and this is where the survey, I think, is really quite interesting, is that you do something like, I got your back, you got my back. So it's friendship. It's not, I got your back, you don't have to have my back. Sorry, that was really bad grammar, but, creative licenses.
It's okay.
But so that's why only half the people you think are your friends are actually your friends, because in fact, they don't got your back.
No, they don't have your back. And this is the thing, right? I was watching this show by Simon Sinek. He is a motivational speaker in the US. You can actually watch this particular video on YouTube.
What is it called?
It's called Circle of Trust by Simon Sinek, S-I-N-E-K. And he talks about the fact that sometimes when you draw a circle of trust, it's an imaginary line, of course, and you draw people inside the circle of trust, no matter what happens within that circle of trust, you know members within that circle of trust actually got your back.
Mm.
The problem is when you can't let anyone in that circle of trust because you're not too sure if this person is going to backstab you when you're not watching.
I have to say, this isn't just a theoretical discussion. There's a reason why it's important to be aware of who your friends are, right? Because, you know me, I love quotes. There's this quote by Jim Rohn, and he said that you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with.
Oh,
yes.
Very interesting.
Yes.
Very interesting.
Think about the five people that you spend the most time with.
Yeah.
And you can see that, in fact, you are the sum of parts of that. Mm-hmm. You are the average of that. And that's why it's important to choose the people that you surround yourself with. Because if you surround yourself with whingers and whiners and pessimistic people, mm-hmm. you too take on those characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, so I already have that five people in mind.
Very good. I am struggling for that.
Yeah.
I was really struggling with the five people. Who do I spend the most time with?
Yeah, probably me, I suppose.
And the fact of the matter is, the most time you spend is often in the office, right?
Absolutely.
So you've got your nucleus family, that may be your partner, your parents, that you spend the most time with. But for most of us in the working world, we spend the most time with our colleagues. And the thing is, you can't choose your colleagues.
You can't.
So,
well, unless you're the boss and you can.
Yeah, that's true. Well, let's not talk about the bosses here.
But before joining here in this place, I was working about 10 to 14 hours on average, 10 mm-hmm. to 14 hours at the workplace. And we have a small nucleus team there. It's about four or five of us. And we spend the most of our waking hours with these five individuals, right? Me included. And we realized that we kind of build the characteristic of each other. The five of us was meld into one.
Birds of a feather,
birds
right?
of a feather.
Yes, and kind of start resembling each
and
other.
And anyone in that organization that deals with any one of us would kind of, expect the kind of same result from any of us.
Because
we're behaving in the same way.
Which is an argument that can be made as to why you should, be happy that only half of your friends do actually like you.
Yeah.
So you can eliminate that, the unwanted. So your circle gets smaller. And I had a conversation with Sherrod about this not too long ago. That as you get older, your social circle gets smaller. Your inner social circle.
Yeah.
So your social circle, you may know more people, but the people you treasure and keep close and hold dear become smaller and smaller.
But the relationship will be deepened even further. So, you start off your life in primary school with a lot of friends. So imagine, you're having a very wide array of friends, but your relationship is not that deep. It's like a mile wide of friends, but a foot deep of relationship. But as you grow older, it becomes an inverted triangle and you have just a foot wide of friends, but a mile deep in relationship.
Which bodes the question, as an adult, how do you make friends?
You don't.
Yeah, that's hard.
So
how do you make friends?
Facebook can help.
No, you have to. So I also read an article that encourages people to delete the friends they have in Facebook because your friends are not your friends on Facebook.
Yeah.
Your friends are your friends in real life.
Yeah, I have that thing, right? I every now and then I do look at my friends list and I haven't even spoken to any of these, people for the past 10
Malaysia,
years.
Malaysia, it seems, that Malaysia ranks as one of the highest. Malaysians tend to have the most number of friends on Facebook.
Yep.
And I don't know whether that means Malaysia is Malaysians are quite friendly or whether we just add people.
No, we just add people. That's all there is to it, right?
But the pros and cons of that. The pros are you keep in touch with people that you've never kept in touch with.
Yeah.
And the cons are you really don't keep in touch with the people that you've never kept in touch
Absolutely.
with.
Absolutely. It's a double-edged sword.
Yes.
And we covered this news a few months back when Facebook opened their corporate office here in Kuala Lumpur. And we realized that corporate office is mostly on sales and they want to target, companies trying to advertise on Facebook. But there's a reason why they opened it in Kuala Lumpur because globally we are particularly entrenched in using Facebook as a relationship mechanism, and it makes sense for a company like Facebook trying to advertise here. But the question is, are we brave enough to actually delete friends on Facebook?
I was just going to ask you. You read my mind. I was going to say, are you going to go back after this, Ibrahim, and look at your, I don't know how many friends you have, but look at that list and go, I'm going to delete a quarter of the people that I don't know on Facebook.
You know what? Let's talk about quotes, right? And this is a quote that I read somewhere. I don't remember where, but this quote says, when was the last time you did something new? And I can't answer that really, because I'm the same old kind of guy.
This can be your new thing.
This
for the
can
day.
Be my new thing for today. So friends on Facebook, watch out.
Do people know if you delete them on Facebook?
No, you don't.
Or they don't know. They don't know. Okay.
But
so it's a covert thing. You can delete someone.
It is
they
a covert
know.
Thing. But when you want to like score ding the other friend of yours, and you realize, you know, oh my god, I'm no longer friends with that person, then that's the realization.
Well, let's cross that bridge down the road. Here's a completely apt song for this conversation, Red Hot Chili Peppers with My Friends, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.